Show. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! About last night. That sounds like the beginning of a really tortured apology. It's not as terrifying as it, or gross as it sounds. No, sorry about last night. I had fully intended to be on the air, but I had to meet my colleague Bo over in Beckley as he returned from AIC headquarters in D.C. to pick up the headquarters key, because Ferg and I will in turn be journeying to D.C. on Sunday. And it's tough to get in without a key. They frown on crowbars there in on Capitol Hill. Anyway, that's what kept me away from the microphone. I didn't get back until 7:30. So my apologies, sincerely. This is The Horn, headonradionetwork.com. Available most easily by simply going to headonradionetwork.com and clicking the Listen Live button. But if you're out and about and you want to listen on your mobile device, your smartphone, as the hip young kids are calling them these days, Bob, you can also get various and sundry apps that make it real easy, too. TuneIn Radio being one of them. The TuneIn Radio Premier or Prime or whatever app, Pro app, costs a couple of bucks, but it also allows you to record the program. That makes things handy, doesn't it? Kind of like a DVR for your HORN. Sure. There are other apps, too, that we are highly respectful of. Things like, Stitcher Internet Radio. There are great websites like Streama.com and Dar.fm. And Roku devices. Any number of places where you can get your hands or ears on The Horn. And we hope you will, and we hope you'll tell your friends and neighbors, growing by leaps and bounds. It means something to continue to build and grow the Horn family. And speaking of The Horn, oh, hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. Did I mention that? You just make these assumptions, right? Yeah, it's Friday on the front porch, and there's something really special happening tomorrow in New York City. You may recall a few weeks back, Brother Albert called, back before the turn of the new year. Brother Albert called to share with us the joyous announcement of the birth of his wonderful young son, Leto. And we have shared other things, graduations, births, right. I don't recall us getting... the Horn family, I don't recall us getting to share remotely in a wedding. So I just got a great big smile all over earlier when I got a note from our friend Kim, member of the Horn family, Kim, in New York. The note, and I'm going to print this one out and just add it to the collection. This says, hi, Bob. Hope you and your family are well. We are. I know this is an unusual request, but I'm getting married tomorrow, Saturday, to my fiancé, Matthew, who is even further to the left than I am. Yay! We met approximately 2 years ago, and I introduced him to your show. Needless to say, he instantly became a fan, and your show each night has been a sort of soundtrack to our relationship. That's just wonderful. I was wondering if you could play Here Comes the Sun by the Beatles during tonight's show as a dedication to him and to let him know how much I love him and cannot wait to be his wife. It would mean so much to us if you played a role in our joyous occasion. It means so much to us to be included, Kim. So tomorrow, as you say your vows, whatever they are, together, however you choose to do it, know that the happy best wishes of the Horn family go with you and stay with you and abide with you, and that we share some remote measure of what we hope is great and manifest joy in both your lives together. Just got a note in from Kim. Happy wedding. Happy wedding to you both, Kim and Matthew. Just got a note in from Kim, sitting here crying while you're reading my email. Thank you for your best wishes. No thanks needed, Kim, Matthew. No thanks needed whatsoever. It is our joy, our privilege, and our honor that you include the Horn family in such a wonderful event. Shucks, I always cry at weddings. Apparently even at a distance the day before. That's a wonderful way to begin our Friday on the front porch. Yeah, wonderful. Kim, we will be wanting pictures. Okay. Snapshots are fine. Cell phone pictures are fine, but just, I don't know, send along a couple in the email and we'll share them. That's just wonderful. So this is Friday on the front porch, and there's a lot to cover this evening. A gentle reminder as we begin, somehow or another this week we have gotten ourselves into rather a nasty hole as far as fundraising is concerned. PayPal buttons at headonradionetwork.com. PayPal address, if you just want to go to PayPal and choose personal and gift, is bobkincaid@gmail.com. I mention this because we will have some interruptions of the show in the coming week. I don't know how many. I hope none. But tomorrow, let's get this scheduling in order. Tomorrow, treat! Tomorrow, we have a Prism West Virginia American History Chat. The first of the new semester, an entirely new topic. Professor Keith Lilly and Dr. Bill O'Brien will be doing the conversation. There's a chat room over at Prism, PRISMWV.org, where you can also go and just one-stop shop and click on the video. Okay? Now, that is from 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time. There's a whole new semester of master's degree level American history, American public affairs teaching about to take off. So if you jump in now, you'll be able to follow it through its logical progression. 3 to 5 p.m. Eastern Time. That is, of course, noon to 2 Pacific. And then on Sunday, Ferg and I head for D.C. We are renewing we're renewing the AIC Act in the case of the House of Representatives. And since we've got a brand spanking new Congress, we are beginning the efforts to get the AIC Act introduced in the Senate of the United States. So that's going to take up our time. We will also, and the plan is for me to be there, for us to be there up into the beginning of February. So like I said, this is going to be a long haul. The rig, however, the broadcast rig is going with us, and I plan on being able to be on the air every night. But if not every night, most nights, and I will tweet and I will Facebook, and we will post at headonradionetwork.com to let people know from day to day. But assume there will be a show. But it is only fair. It's only fair to say that we have gotten ourselves this week into a fundraising hole, and so it was with real real appreciation when I saw a note come in from Dr. John saying he had determined that it was time for his $50 challenge, and that is tonight, this Friday on the front porch of the 11th day of January 2013. Dr. John noting it's an excellent way for anybody who wants to double their money to double their money, and somebody gives five, he's got five, up to $50, so we can make $50 turn into $100 real easy tonight. And, you know, we try to raise $150 a night anyway. So the PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com, and the snail mail address is there, too. So Dr. John's challenge is on the table for the remainder of the program. And if we could meet and exceed that, it would be wonderful. Congratulations coming in to Kim and Matthew from Michael. And he says, congrats to the soon-to-be newlyweds. Coolest thing I've heard so far this year. But are they sure they don't want that uber imam, ultimate rabbi, super pope, crazy preacher man who shows up on Wednesday nights to administer the vows on the blood-red carpet? Michael says, I kid. Congratulations again. No, we would not let him anywhere near the ceremony. Never know, he might get carried away in the spirit and start talking about Hutsut Rala on the Rillera on a Brawla Suet or something like that. So, where to start this evening? A couple of places. One of which is, there's real live, honest to goodness, no kidding, news out there. And I've got it right here in front of me. But also just a little tale from the trench, if I may. A little tale from the trenches of the uninsured. The uninsured, that would be me. Me and several million other Americans that the for-profit healthcare industry, the Republican Party, the teabaggers, and various sundry assorted conservatives do not care whether they live or die. Actually, they do care. They would prefer we die. You know, what Alan Grayson said. Don't get sick, and if you do get sick, die quickly. So, I take a little handful of medication every day. No, none of them are Thorazine. So far, the voices in my head haven't gotten that bad yet. The voices in my head say things like, chocolate! Now! Wait, no, I don't have any voices in my head that sound like Alex Jones. Stop that. No, I take a handful of medications, and most of them, fortunately, are on the so-called $4 formulary. You know, the purple thing that keeps me from turning into a nasty, gurdy little mess. And there's another one that keeps my blood pressure from taking the top of my skull off. And yeah. But there is this one drug that I take, and I don't mind telling you, it's not a shame or anything. Given my Scots-Irish ancestry, I am, as we have discussed in the past, a triglyceride factory. That's one of those reasons that the last physician I saw figured that I'm having those, you know, funny little pains. But, you know, why worry about what you can't fix, right? I take a medication that is specifically designed to reduce the triglycerides in one's blood. And one's body generally, I guess. Because I'm a factory. When I don't take this stuff, my triglycerides go up to places that just makes the blood drain out of physicians' faces. With it, it slowly lowers itself to a level where doctors look at the numbers and go, well, that's high, but, you know, you're you, and maybe that's your normal. We can keep working on that. The drug is by Abbott Labs, and it's called Tricor. And let's see, I've priced it at Walmart, and it's $180 a month. Yes, I walked into Walmart under those circumstances. I have priced it at Kmart, and it was $183. Priced it down to the Rite Aid, and it was $240. Nothing right about Rite Aid. And then there's a pharmacy over at the local hospital, and they sell at or below cost. And so I go there. I was paying about $60 a month for the prescription. This really is going to make sense in a minute. Thank you for the kind contribution that just came in. Thanks a lot, Sal. Did I say Dr. Bill? No, if I said Dr. Bill, I made a mistake. Dr. John's $50 challenge. And our good friend Brandon just responded. There's something to help keep the lights on, says Brandon. Happy Friday on the front porch. Thank you, Brandon. Thank you kindly. Uh, But anyway, I was getting this drug, Tricor, manufactured by Abbott Labs, for about $50 a month. And that's, you know, even at $50 a month, there are choices made. Agnes kind of has a hand in them. It includes sentences like, "No, dummy, you're buying the medicine. You're not getting an oil change this month." Yeah. So I was surprised, having budgeted when I, you know, like I said, I'm getting ready to go to D.C., took my last dose today, so had to go over, get them refilled. And I was surprised today when they told me that my Tricor prescription would be $102 instead of, you know, $60. And quickly doing math on the fly in my head, I said, "Why, that's $42 more than I'm used to paying." And the response was, "Well, yeah, that's, but this one's a generic." At which point I, you know, cartoon thing. The generic is more expensive than the name brand drug. And I don't offer this story as any sort of rightness or wrongness or any kind of plea for help or any... No, no, no. But I was curious. But shouldn't the generic be cheaper than the name brand? Well, yeah, but we were getting the name brand on a schedule that allowed us to charge a lower price. Oh, okay, who am I? So $102 it is. But then, and I don't know why I do these things. In this case, I'm glad I did. Then I reached in the little white paper bag with all the drugs in it, and I opened the top on my fenofibrate. It now no longer says Tricor in the bottle. It says fenofibrate. And shook a couple of the little bastards out into my hand. Guess what? My fenofibrate was identical to my Tricor. And when I say identical, I'm not using that term loosely. I mean identical. I mean, for instance, I've been through three or four different generic brands, generic versions of my blood pressure medication. One of them was a little yellow pill, another little pink pill. Right now it's a little white square. Yeah, whatever. They're all the same generic substance, but they are differently made in different houses. Different, well, factories. Labs? Yeah, probably labs. But in the case of my Tricor / fenofibrate, no! I shook the little bastards out in my hand, and it was the same oval shape. It was the same size. It had the same Abbott Labs logo on one side and the same letter and number combination on the other. At which point I said, "Wait a minute. You sure this didn't come out of a bottle marked Tricor?" "Oh, no, no, no. We've got the bottle right here. See? Show me the bottle." And that left me just a little bit stymied. So I asked a couple of questions. "Well, you know, with things like Coumadin, all Coumadin pills, even if they're generic or brand name, all Coumadin pills look the same because... it's a dangerous enough drug that we want all healthcare providers to be able to recognize it immediately on site." Okay, great. This is not that. This is a relatively benign fenofibritic acid triglyceride reducer. And this wasn't the generic version of anything. this was the same thing as the brand name. Now, I'm not putting any of this off on the pharmacy. They charge the prices that are, it's basically a subsidized pharmacy. It's about as close to being socialized as you can get and still be paying cash. They actually charge less in some instances than the drugs actually cost. But the pharmacist there was very understanding, and she went so far as to look up the drug, and she said, well, I'm being given a notification here on the website that the laboratory is not able to meet production of the drug. And it's back ordered through mid-February. So check back with us then. And I'm still trying to sort that one out in my head. Maybe it's just because, you know, silly old English major, liberal arts kind of guy that I am. I just don't understand. Maybe I don't understand business. But I think in this scenario, there's also a possibility that I just don't understand fraudulent business practices. Need a couple of words in front of business and a word in front of business and a word behind it. But I thought of this story also in conjunction with something that Tamara said the other night when we were talking on another topic, and I had mentioned that one of the things that we tell our youngsters is that, you know, we're not being all 13th century about sex when we tell them that it is best that they not do it young and it's better that they not do it drunk because sex can kill you. And Tamer wrote in and said, yeah, sex can kill you, and not just HIV/AIDS. And Tamer mentioned that there was that there's a strain of gonorrhea out there that responds to only one class of antibiotics. And lo and behold, today, in the course of doing show research, I ran across a story that mentioned that very same issue, this strain of gonorrhea, and it's been, there were trials, or this was noted in a hospital in Toronto. And it's a strain of gonorrhea that is resistant to all other antibiotics except this one, I think it's cephalosporins, Keflex, you know. And lo and behold, there were seven people in that hospital in Toronto whose version of gonorrhea no longer responds to that either. So read, paragraph. Using my little fingers on the screen and trying to keep my lips from moving at the same time. It's embarrassing, lips moving while you're reading silently. It's even worse when I'm sitting there with my tongue sticking out, you know, like it's really struggling. I generally only do that when I come across words like, you know, cephalosporin. But I came to this paragraph that said, and it's not likely to get any better. Why, says I to myself, and the article responds, saying it's because research leading to new antibiotics to treat a relatively small handful of patients for something that is a relatively small problem don't have enough profitability put into it. There's just not room for profitability inside the problem. You see, that's where we are. That's where we are in healthcare. That's where we are in medicine. That's where we are. Whether or not someone can be cured of something that should not be a problem in the 21st century. And by not a problem, I don't mean people don't make dumb sex choices that wind up getting them things like gonorrhea. I mean, should not be a problem from a technological standpoint, become problems because there's no room to build in the price point of lobsters for lunch. You get my meaning? There's all kinds of stuff going sideways inside the pharmaceutical industry, arising out of what happened at, what was it, the New England Compounding Pharmacy that put out those steroids that were contaminated with a fungus that killed a bunch of people and is still making people sick, perhaps. And I thought, profitability. We're still not quite to that Star Trek place where we wonder, where we consider the most good done for the most people in our scientific choices. We're still at one of those Ayn Rand places where we consider the most good done for a very small group of people. I mean, probably the number of people who would profit by building the lobster lunches into a gonorrhea cure, probably that group is smaller than the group of people who suffer from the lack of the gonorrhea cure. The difference being that the people who wound up with gonorrhea got it inadvertently and not by choice, whereas the people who suffer from the greed disease that makes science bow down in abject worship of profit, well, as the old saying goes, they were born that way. And so here we are. Here am I. There are you. Moving from day to day and never knowing where we're going to get gouged next. Imagine that. Now, see, I hearken back to my little, you know, we packed a lot into those couple of weeks that I was in Europe. Inadvertently. You might well recall that little Belgian bastard who stole my backpack that had all my medicines in it back then. Well, it had a bottle of Tricor in it at the time. And all the other medicines. And I had the amazing experience of going from one pharmacy to the next. Well, No. I had the amazing experience first of paying, I think, $12 for a doctor's appointment at the walk-in clinic in Frankfurt. Very, very, very nice fellow. Yes, what can we do for you, sir? Explain my problem. Ah, yes, we will look up the generic equivalents. Yes, and this, yes, your blood pressure medicines will be, and he tells me, and your cholesterol. Oh, no, okay, that is American brand name. Fenofibrate, yes, it will be that much. And he gives me all the prescriptions. And by looking into his magic computer box, he can tell me how much every one of those prescriptions is going to be, whether I take it to a pharmacy in Frankfurt, a pharmacy in Münster, a pharmacy in Berlin, Leipzig, Stuttgart, wherever. It's the same price, every pharmacy. Because they have a rational system of healthcare delivery. On the other hand, I mentioned a few moments ago that I went to price my Tricor, which really is important because if I don't take it, then my gallbladder goes nuts. It in turn sets off a war in my pancreas, which then creates some sort of Vietnamese domino theory to happen in my colon. And the next thing you know, I'm chewing up opiates for the refreshing burst of flavor and living on water for the next 3 weeks. But no, for the Tricor, like I said, Kmart, Rite Aid, CVS, Wally World, different price everywhere, based not upon need, based not upon the difficulty of production of the drug, but based entirely upon whatever role the sale of that medication plays in whether or not a goddamn dividend is declared at the end of whatever particular quarter we're in on godforsaken Wall Street. And so I drove back home feeling like I had just been to the funhouse, the pharmaceutical funhouse, and had been dealt a hand of three-card Monte. Queen's right there. I know right, but right. Oh, damn. Because the Queen wasn't right there. Yeah. And again, this is not a poor, poor, pitiful me story. This is not a woe is me story. This is a woe is us story. Because this happened to me, and I know for daggum sure that it is happening all over this country that is being liquidated for profit. By country, I don't mean quarter acres and half hectares. By country, I mean we, the people of the United States, struggling more futilely every day to create a more perfect union because we are opposed by a bunch of freaks who have a sickness in their mind that says that profit is the only thing that matters. It doesn't matter whether it's some fat ass hillbilly with Scots Irish extraction, or whether it's somebody who unfortunately got a dose of the clap. The people with the sick brains are out there. Oh, I wonder. Wait a second. Add this to this and divide by, and carry the 12. And fractionalize and reduce it to present value. By God, we'll have a dividend this quarter on those sad, sorry sacks of. And you'll pardon me, I hope, for getting a little. Well, you know, pissed off about it. Not just for me, but for everybody who is, for all intents and purposes, on an assembly line that leads into the maw of Wall Street. You know, I mentioned earlier that we're going to go to D.C. to work on the AIC Act. The reason we have to press for an AIC Act is, you know, the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act. The reason we have to press for that, beg for that, advocate for that, plead for that, ask you to help us get it done. The reason we have to do that is because there's a relative minority of people who get rich. And I mean spaceship money rich. Pumping toxins into the air, the water, the soil to get after seams of coal barely a foot thick. And who give not a tinker's damn about 4,000 excess deaths in West Virginia alone per year. People who live near mountaintop removal sites, people who had mountaintop removal sites come to them, who never moved toward the sites, who merely sat on their old family home places generation after generation, living successfully, perhaps subsistently. But one day, awoke to bombs going off over their heads. And a fallout of toxic dust that'll make you sick just by being in it for minutes. That's our reality. Oh, yes, Lord, yes, that is our reality. So I just kind of had to share that. It wanted sharing. Because there's nothing the profit motive will not poison. I've got a story here from The Guardian from 2 days ago. There's nowhere that the profit motive will not poison our attempt at a rational culture. Headline, mass donor organ fraud shakes Germany. I saw that and went, oh, no. I think I've kind of... Well... German medical authorities are calling for an extensive overhaul of the country's organ transplant program after transplant centers across Germany were placed under criminal investigation over allegations that they had systematically manipulated donor waiting lists. Really? Really? There's an investigation of dummying up the donor waiting lists in Germany? When you're done there, could you come over here, please, and tell us how it is that Richard B. Dick Big Time Cheney ran to the head of the heart transplant list when somebody under his circumstances ordinarily should not have gotten anywhere near the top of said list? Because if they were able to find it in Germany, I'll bet you they'd probably find it here. Scores of patients are believed to have been given priority access to donor organs. I wonder what patients. I mean, is it... Could it? You reckon it's some? Some 4-year-old, lower class kid from Hamburg who got boosted to the top of the list? Because I'm betting the answer to that is no. No, I'm figuring it's probably some plutocrat from the top of some damn tower in Frankfurt. What would that be? Ich brauche ein neuer Herz. Ja? Wie viel Geld haben Sie? Vielen Geld. Ja? Gut. Sorry, I just have to trot my German out every now and then. That was probably terrible, wasn't it? Sorry. I'm trying! Scores of patients are believed to have been given priority access to donor organs after doctors falsified the severity of their illnesses to ensure they received treatment ahead of other patients in Europe. Oh, it's not just Germany. The revelations have led to accusations of widespread corruption and dishonesty in the system and shattered public trust. Since the scandal emerged last year as a handful of cases that were initially believed to be isolated incidents you know, kind of the way Dick Cheney was an isolated incident, kind of the way that Steve Jobs was, you know, an isolated incident, the number of Germans willing to donate organs has plummeted. I can't blame them. People donate organs upon death as an act of sublime altruism. They're paid nothing for it. Their families receive no compensation because that is deemed by the medical community to be unethical. On the other hand, however, over on the side of the aisle that apparently doesn't have to fool with that ethics business, yeah, that's a different story. Post-death donations have dropped by between 20 and 40%, according to the German Foundation for Organ Transplantation, which said the public's faith had been massively shaken. Investigations across the country have revealed that in at least four clinics, patient data was distorted or falsified in order to improve patients' chances of getting an organ. At least 107 cases of obvious manipulation have come to light so far. At one clinic in Munich, doctors were accused of active manipulation of data after investigators discovered cases in which patients' blood samples were mixed with urine to make them appear sicker than they were. Urine in the blood is an indication that internal organs are no longer functioning properly. In two further cases, blood samples were submitted from a person who had never even been a patient at the clinic. Clinics have come under investigation in Göttingen, Regensburg, Munich, and Leipzig. All of them are university teaching hospitals with hitherto excellent reputations. Experts blame the growing competition between clinics, which are increasingly coming under pressure to boost revenue. Revenue. Money. The worldwide shortage of organ donors exacerbates the problem. Senior doctors and transplant surgeons across the four clinics have been suspended pending further investigations. Surgeons in Leipzig are accused of blocking the investigation by Germany's General Medical Council after claiming to have mislaid patients' notes. Really? Including details of who was receiving dialysis treatment. The documents finally came to light this month, allegedly revealing a similar pattern of data manipulation. In Leipzig, there have been at least 38 cases of data manipulation reported. It goes on and on and on, this article does. But at the bottom line, The Guardian doesn't really answer the bottom line question. Who went to the head of the list? And why? Because remember, Dick Cheney is out there wandering around with some decent human being's heart beating in his chest. Meanwhile, you can make almost statistically certain that some decent human being desperately in need of a heart went begging. Nah, didn't go begging, went dying. Maybe we could find out by looking and seeing if there were any... Nah, that would all be done privately and quietly, wouldn't it? They're not going to open up the Richard B. Dick Big Time Cheney Heart Transplant Institute endowed chair anywhere, are they? No. But rest assured, the problem that at least is being addressed or investigated in Europe gets little more than a wink and a nudge
How do you like? You want to see my scar? Yeah. I'm so pale now, if we shine a light behind me, you might even be able to see my new heart.
Yeah, a man who was complicit in the murder of God knows how many thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, perhaps a million Iraqi civilians, as well as members of Afghan wedding parties and whatnot, is still plodding around. Going to sleep nightly in the box with a little bit of soil from the old country in it. Count Dicula walks. Because we have a problem, we won't investigate. While at least people in Europe investigate theirs.
No, really. You remember when I didn't have a pulse? I've got one now. Yeah. I meet people now and they say, Dick, you look so much happier. And I say, that's because I've got the heart of a 12-year-old. You want to feel it? You want to listen? Sheesh.
So just a couple of little items to get us started on this Friday on the front porch. We've got, we've got other stuff out there. How's about, just for the fun of it, an argument by the right-wing gun goobs, that slavery never would have happened if only black folk had been able to have guns. Yeah, I know. See, we know history here. We know that there were lots of slave uprisings, and that every time that happened, the people who uprose with their guns were shot the hell down, and probably some of their family, too. Nat Turner comes to mind. Nat Turner led a slave rebellion. 60 white folks died. 100 black folks died. In addition to the 100 who were killed right out, there were 56 more executed who were accused of being involved in it. And then the mobs went out and beat and killed at least 200 other individuals. This is one of those you got to hear it to believe it kind of things. All this happened because you may recall we were talking about the fact that Gun Appreciation Day is January the 19th. They had Larry Ward on CNN today. He's the chairman, you may remember, of Gun Appreciation Day. Don't believe me. Listen to Larry Ward. And scream if you need to scream. That's okay. Screaming works.
Let's talk about the theater issue with Larry, because for some people, seeing people carrying weapons out in the open, it is intimidating. It scares them. It has the opposite effect of what you're probably after.
Well, first I'd like to address the Martin Luther King Day charge, and I want to say, you know, wholeheartedly, and this is sincere, and if you let me, explain, I believe that Gun Appreciation Day honors the legacy of Dr. King.
No, he said that. Bono sings. Shots rang out. Yeah. No, they're going to honor Dr. King by worshiping their guns. Yeah. Same kind of guns that James Earl Ray. Don't send me email about how James Earl Ray didn't do it, please. I think there may have been a conspiracy there, but
We're looking for a peaceful protest. We're looking for people to come out and to let and remind the members of Congress and the president how we feel about our Second Amendment. And the truth is, I think Martin Luther King would agree with me if he were alive today, that if African Americans had been given the right to keep and bear arms from day one of the country's founding, perhaps slavery might not have been a chapter in our history. And
I have to tell you that split screen with Larry Ward, Gun Goob, is a woman of color. And when he said that, I think they had her mic off, because all of a sudden she just kind of starched up and her mouth came open. Ha! Ha! And that's probably the noises she was making, except they had the mic off.
I believe I wholeheartedly that it's essential to liberty.
Maria, I know Maria's itching the comment.
That is ridiculous. Slavery means that you are a possession. Slaves are a possession just like a gun. So to say that if slaves had been armed, first, that's theater. So let's talk about the real issue.
No, it's
similar to the theater in Aurora that wanted to have a memorial service for the victims there, but they forgot to talk to victims. And what they thought was a great idea became offensive. Your Gun Appreciation Day, on the whole, it's your right. It's your American right. But you didn't speak to anyone about it. And I think that in itself speaks to the theater. There is selfish, self-serving intent in a Gun Appreciation Day. If you speak to, and I've spoken to many people, thousands of people, they are outraged that you would plan your event 2 days before an American icon's day that we celebrate nationally, who was murdered. He was slain by a rifle. I think we need to step back and really...
Now, see, there she goes. That's how it is.
What is the intent of these Gun Appreciation Days? Why not appreciate victims? Why not appreciate amendment? But Gun Appreciation Day is really a power play. That's what it speaks to me.
The 25,000
people.
But we have to wrap it up right now. I apologize.
Please,
but I thank
join
you.
Me on signup.org to find a petition against Gun Appreciation Day.
And
this
go to Gun Appreciation Day and show up on the January 19th.
All right. I appreciate the even-tempered conversation. It was actually a nice change.
Yeah, I appreciate it, too. But not that much. You got that? I will not scream. I will not throw a fit. I will not carry on. But mercy sakes. Did you hear Martin Luther King, who was killed by a rifle? And you can hear if you listen very carefully, you can hear all over America when Maria Roach of Change.org said Martin Luther King was killed by a rifle. You can hear little paranoid white people all over the country. No, he wasn't. He's killed by a man with a rifle. Guns don't kill people. People kill people. People with rifles. Just about, Angry Indian, he said that. Got a couple of emails like that. Dr. John, whose challenge is only $10 from being met, I might add. Gun Appreciation Day honors the legacy of Dr. King. Dr. John succinctly, dumbass white man did not say that. Dumbass white man did say that. Yeah, because, you know, if only Jesse had had a gun, he could have shot back there on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel. Michael writes in, he says, see, this is what I was trying to say the other day, Bob. It's not about the inauguration. These goobs are racist. And the timing with MLK Day is no accident. They know what they're doing. And it kind of came home to me. It kind of came home to me just the other... this is how it came home to me. We got a skinhead... With one of those pubic hair scrotum chins. He's a Balchinian, I think. Guy's last name is Yeager. James Yeager. He is, of course, from Tennessee. Although one could just as easily have believed he was from, you know, Alabama Stan, Mississippi Stan, Kentucky Stan. You know the drill. Georgia Stan. He's the CEO of a Tennessee company that specializes, Raw Story says, in weapons and tactical training. And he posted a video on YouTube, the audio of which you are about to hear, and which should make little hairs stand up on the back of your neck, and which he promptly tried to disappear from his YouTube account, but fortunately, some folks had already caught it. Here's what he says to you and to me.
Fuck that. I'm telling you that if that happens, it's going to spark a civil war, and I'll be glad to fire the first shot. I'm not putting up with it. You shouldn't put up with it. And I need all you patriots to start thinking about what you're going to do. Load your damn mags. Make sure your rifle's clean. Pack a backpack with some food in it and get ready to fight. I'm not fucking putting up with this. I am not letting my country be ruled by a dictator. I'm not letting anybody take my guns. If it goes one inch further, I'm going to start killing people.
The F that part was in response. Well, the part that you didn't get was Vice President Joe Biden is asking the President to bypass Congress and use executive privilege, executive order to ban assault rifles and impose stricter gun control. That's when he says, this is not over anything, but that's when he says,
fuck that. I'm telling you that if that happens, it's going to spark a civil war, and I'll be glad to fire the first shot. I'm not putting up with it. You shouldn't put up with it. And I need all you patriots to start thinking about what you're going to do. Load your damn mags. Make sure your rifle's clean. Pack a backpack with some food in it and get ready to fight. I'm not fucking putting up with this. I am not letting my country be ruled by a dictator. I'm not letting anybody take my guns. If it goes one inch further, I'm going to start killing people.
That's one of those National Rifle Association lawful gun owners. Now, are there consequences to talk like that? Yes, as I am informed by a person who wishes to remain anonymous. Yeah, the state of Tennessee suspended James Yeager's gun permit. As they should have. Because he manifested himself to not be a law-abiding gun owner. Because, see, he crossed the line into incitement, and inciting a riot is criminal conduct. by way of excuse, he said, I was mad when I said it and probably allowed my mouth to overrun my logic. Now, I don't condone anybody doing anything rash or committing any kind of felonies up to it, including aggravated assaults and murders, unless it is necessary. Right now, it's not necessary. He's a prepper, apparently. On his website, he says, if the world collapses, not only am I going to survive, I'm going to be the fucking king. I'm James Yeager, and I'm prepared for everything, he says, with a gun in his hand. But not a cooking pot, or a bag of rice, or anything to filter out clean water. I guess he's going to eat his gunpowder. He describes his training room as a frat house, but with machine guns. Yeah. And this is over assault rifles. This isn't over hunting rifles. This isn't over personal protection, you know, having a revolver or a handgun or whatever in the house. No, this is over having stockpiles of assault weapons, you know, for your little private and paramilitary organization. Yeah. Nice, huh? And all of these paranoid white gun goobs always fall back on that BS about how we're going to protect from a government that's gone tyrannical on boot on our neck and abiding it. But as Ron and Raleigh pointed out to me earlier today, there's a fascinating article over at Black Agenda Report, blackagendareport.com, The Real and Racist Origins of the Second Amendment. Bruce, B.A.R., Black Agenda Report Managing Editor Bruce Dixon wrote it. It was written, actually, back in 2008. And it points out that the Second Amendment is there to enable slave hunters. To see, slave hunters didn't just go looking for runaway slaves to politely ask them to return, as Colonel Whitmore P. Spittlepants did in that letter that he sent to his former slave after the Civil War, asking him to come back and work on the plantation, that was responded to, and you can read over at lettersofnote.com. Yeah. Now, let us understand, then, that the Constitution contains the only crime defined in the Constitution of the United States is treason. If a new government expects people to rise up if it just gets a little too tyrannical, well, that treason passage would not be in the Constitution, now, would it? So all these paranoid white gun goobs that are going to protect us when the government goes too far, but the government didn't go too far when it, you know, passed the Patriot Act. It didn't go too far when the DIM leader ordered unconstitutional domestic wiretapping and spying. It didn't go too far when they took habeas corpus out behind the barn and just beat the living shit out of it. They didn't go too far. They didn't go too far when they marched into the home of an 80-year-old man recently in Utah, whose wife had just passed away of cancer. Korean War vet, man was. He was holding his hand, or he was holding the hand of his just departed wife, as she had just expired.
They had been together for a very long time. And that's when the knock came at the door. It was the police. They had come to seize whatever pain medications she might have had remaining after her agonizing, pain-ridden death from cancer. But the gun goobs didn't rise up against that now either, did they? No. The only thing they can imagine rising up against is the tyranny of that Negro in the White House is trying to take our guns. Apparently they didn't go too far. As Marty points out, when the black survivors of Katrina in New Orleans were all disarmed, while the white ones got to keep their guns. You don't remember wrong, Marty. Jesus, they disgust me. But it is Friday on the front porch, isn't it? I need to keep reminding myself that. So we're going to take a little break and come back and do some conversating. One line is on hold on Skype. One line is on hold on the phone. And other lines on the phone are open. 304-658-3333. This is Conversation Radio. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. I love the part in the chorus where he says, if only Dr. King had had a gun.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
Minutes past the hour here in hour number two of this Friday on the front porch. Yeah, I'm going to open the front porch gate here in a minute. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. Pleased to announce that Dr. John's Friday evening challenge has been met. And with it, a comment coming from Texas Betsy. She proposes the Beat the Betsy bet just to get caught up a little bit this evening. She, too, has put forward $50 to see if there might be any further matches to that. Don't let Betsy down. If you can, if you haven't lately, kick in. It would be a huge help. Indeed it would. That would take care of tonight and a chunk of what didn't happen last night, a little bit of what we were behind on the night before and the night before. So, yes, indeed. Thank you, Betsy. Thank you, indeed. Beat the Betsy bet. Between now and 9 p.m. That's about an hour and 45 minutes. Going right over to the Skype line in just a sec. Granny T in Tennessee, regarding Tennessee Patriot. Well, Bob, that's where I live, among such wonderful, thoughtful, and caring folks such as the Tennessee Patriot. Do not worry yourself about having a cussin' screaming big fit on air. I am at this moment doing so for you and all others who are so inclined. You know, you think you've heard it all, and then along comes an even more advanced specimen of whatever species we have to listen to. Granny T says, I'm thanking the great spirit for you and your intelligent listeners. Thank you, Granny T, and thanks for taking up the swearing slack for us for a little bit, because sometimes, sometimes I get a little and I'm, well, it meant, Nobody likes to make me hear strangulated animal noises. Let's put it that way. So let's go to the Skype line. Tracy has been very patient. Hey, Tracy, are you there?
Can you hear me?
I got you.
Yay. So I don't know where to start. Do I start with Oxygen's new show, All My Baby's Mamas?
Oh, let's don't say we didn't. I'm not over Honey Boo Boo, and now I've got and now I've got to deal with Buck Wild.
Mm-hmm. No. So, yeah, there's a show that is in development. Have you heard about it?
No, I'm terrified.
Okay. So apparently, there's a rapper named Shotty Lowe. And apparently, he has 11 kids and 10 baby mamas. So that means, yes, somebody double dipped.
Well, wouldn't that be him?
Yeah, with the same chick. She didn't learn the first time. So, apparently, Oxygen is developing a television show, a reality show titled...
Wait, isn't Oxygen the one that used to run all those movies with Meredith Baxter Burney that you just knew wasn't going to end well?
Pretty much, yeah, I think so.
Okay.
So, I've never really watched anything on Oxygen, yeah. And now I have even more reason never to watch the Oxygen Network. So, yeah, so it's called All My Baby's Mamas, and it's showing the adventures of Shotty Lowe and all of his baby mamas and all of his babies. So, yeah, there's a petition now out, and I pray that all my Horn family goes to change.org and signs said petition to keep the show from never reaching the air. Oh, and by the way, Rush Limbaugh thinks the show is going to be fabulous.
Really? He's commented.
Mm-hmm.
America's Truth Detector has held forth on this.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wait. even Fox, it has gotten so big, even Fox News has been talking about it. And something called the PTC, the Parental Something Television Council.
Yeah.
They're even commenting on it.
They like it?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, but, you know, even Fox News is, you know, they've actually had stories on it on Fox News.
Well, I'm trying to figure out why Limbaugh would be interested in it. Are there any little boys?
No, but he's saying that's a kind of a that's a lifestyle to admire. You know, one man. I guess it's because it's kind of like a harem.
You know, he's forever saying things like, "I'm Rush Limbaugh with talent on loan from God," and every time I hear that, I think margin call. Yeah, call in that loan. Just call the lot of it in, God.
Please do. No, I just, because I heard about it about a week ago, and I'm just appalled and disgusted. And people are like, well, you know, you got, so what? It's not, no one, it's, you know, Honey Boo Boo is just as bad. Yeah, okay, there's that, but how for never? How many negative images of white folks do you guys see on television? Besides, you know, people on Fox News. And during the Republican National.
Do you really want me to go into my exegesis of Buck Wild right now, Tracy?
Well, but see, you got, for the most part, you don't see as many negative images of black folks on television, because I'm talking about like in the news and whatnot and so forth, to the point that whenever I hear about a gunman or something happening in L.A. and they don't say exactly who it was and you brace yourself and pray that they're not black when something goes wrong because of how black people have been portrayed in the media for UGAT, you know, from minstrel shows on up. So we're going to basically have a modern-day another minstrel show.
Well, wait, hold on just a minute, okay? Because I want to have one of these kinship moments, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You can say that generally about white folks, but you forget I am a hillbilly.
True. But the Beverly Hillbillies weren't
and
that
when
bad.
No, but the thing, no, we do plenty of cringing around here.
Oh, I know you do. I know. Every time somebody even mentions Honey Boo Boo, you're like, really?
And then they call her a hillbilly.
But she's not a hillbilly, is she?
No, she's a cracker. She's a Georgia cracker. Well, no, the word cracker originates, the old baseball team that before the Atlanta Braves ever moved to Atlanta. The Atlanta minor league baseball franchise was the Georgia Crackers. You think I'm kidding? I'm not.
No. But see, what I love about you is like, okay, Tracy, there's a distinction between, now question, coming, you know, from kinship moment to kinship moment. Is there a difference between pole white trash, crackers, and hillbillies?
Absolutely.
See, you know, and I got to know, what's the difference?
No, we don't have enough show.
Oh, but can you just give me the Reader's Digest version, please? You got to give me something.
Hillbillies, generally speaking, come from one of two places.
Okay.
Appalachia or the Ozarks.
Okay, that makes sense. Okay, I got that.
Think Little Abner in the Ozarks. Think, yeah, because remember, the Beverly Hillbillies? Did not come. No. Now, granted, Granny Daisy Moses, now she was from Tennessee. She was from Appalachia.
Okay.
But her daughter married Jed. And Jed was from up the holler somewhere near Bug Tussle. And it was clearly established that that was in the Ozarks. Okay? So that's generally your hillbillies. Now, the hillbilly concept, like hillbilly music, you know, there was a huge hillbilly music scene in, where is it in California? Bakersfield.
Yeah, well, that makes sense.
Isn't that where Buck Owens come from?
I think so, yes. As a matter of fact, I do believe so.
And, now, white trash, and I don't like that term. That's really problematic.
Yeah, I had to ask.
But no, well, no, white trash is what you call folks, or is what more well-heeled white folks would call white folks that they deemed to be on the same par with persons of color, but with a smattering of white privilege about them.
Oh, like the ones that sit under a double wide with three teeth.
No, easy on the trailers. I would give my home and glory, and if I didn't have one, I'd sublet it just to have me a double wide, okay?
No, but the ones that sit in the double wide talking trash about our president and
well,
and
yeah, there's that, but probably the best way to understand what white trash means is to run back to that classic American novel. It's problematic in its own rights. To Kill a Mockingbird. To Kill a Mockingbird, you've got two examples of poor white folk. One of them is the Cunningham bunch. Remember Walter goes to school in the same class as Scout.
Right.
And he comes home for lunch and he's about half starved. And Mr. Cunningham is paying off Atticus in hickory nuts for working on his entailment. Because that means, his entailment means his landlord is trying to screw him out of his land. All right?
Okay.
Well, that's poor white folks. On the other hand, there are the Yules. And the Yules live back behind the dump. And Mr. Bob Yule drinks up his relief check first every month and beats on his children, and he's got a whole heap and clan of young'uns. And it's his daughter, Mayella, that creates the whole problem inside the book and the film, because she makes a pass at Tom Robinson, a black man.
And he says no.
And he says no way. And she gets caught by Bob Yule, who goes ahead and beats the living tar out of her for it, and then cries rape on Tom Robinson. The Yules. That's your white trash.
Gotcha.
Okay. Cracker is an entirely separate topic that goes back to my Appalachian Scots-Irish roots and has to do with the fact that they engaged in corn or maize-based subsistence farming, because the corn, when dried, in order to make meal or grits, has to be cracked.
Oh. See? You know, and I'm wondering if everybody who's listening going, well, gee, we just got a history lesson. in derogatory slang. Hey, not that.
But no, I got to find time, and I got to remember to take his bookmark with me. I was made aware of a post over at I got it right here. Over at the Daily Banter, by apparently a progressive fellow by the name of Ches Pazienza.
Ches Pazienza?
Pazienza.
Oh, Pazienza. Okay.
Yeah. And it's called Don't Cry for Me, Appalachia. And it's about Buckwild.
Now, is this the one that your senator was all up in heels about?
MTV could not... I suspect MTV has since given a campaign contribution to Joe Manchin, because they couldn't have bought better PR. But, yeah. Yeah, it's that show, Buckwild.
Oh, my goodness. when I saw about, you know...
It's on Thursday nights, Tracy. I encourage you, get in there and have a look.
I can't do it.
No, you're working.
I can't do it.
Oh.
No, I have TiVo, so I can watch anything I want.
Just torment yourself through one episode. You know, it's like that Almanad. You know, one episode a week. It's all we ask. Don't watch the whole thing. Don't get hung up on it. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, what they did is they took their success model from Jersey Shore.
Right.
And they found another group of ethnically strange white people. Hillbillies. And I mean, it's real cute because there's, you know, there's one kid, I understood every word he said, but every time he speaks, they subtitle it like he's, you know, speaking Swahili or something.
Like, what was that movie, Snatched, when Brad Pitt would ever speak in what a gypsy language he was speaking, they had to subtitle it because even the English couldn't understand what the hell he was saying?
Right. Well, they subtitled the hillbilly.
Which, you, like you said, but he could you could understand them just fine, but that just adds to it, right? Because you're saying that...
Right.
Uh-huh.
When the English that that kid is speaking is nearer to the English that was spoken by his forebears when they came here 8 or 10 generations ago than anything anybody else is speaking around here.
Oh, see, you know, I just... What is happening with this country that this is considered entertainment? You know, like you said, you know, from the Kardashians to Jersey Shore to Honey Boo Boo and now Buck Wild. And somehow I don't think, because Octogen is standing behind this show, and Shotty Lowe was like, well, you know, don't hate the player, this hate the game, and woo-doo-woo, woo-doo-woo. And I'm like, and I'm going to say it, Negro, please.
Yeah.
You know, do we really need to see more negative images of the black family on television? Do we really need to add to, you know, to the stereotype that black men just father kids and go about their business? Who in the hell? Why the fuck do you have 11 kids?
Yeah, I mean, well. Okay, this is probably not the place for a Mormon or Duggar joke, so I'll just won't.
Be nice. Be nice.
I'm trying.
Be nice. You know, but they're no different from the Mormon. For God's sakes, you know, I'm thinking, I wonder if they're going to be like, if this is going to be like a sister wives kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, well, see, that's the thing. They just rehash and recycle topicality. So you got sister wives, and hey, you know, we could do that only with black people.
Right.
Yeah, because well, you saw that, you saw right before the election that gag, that humorous, political ad that Chris Rock put out that said,
about the, vote for the white guy.
and, you know, there's that one photo of Barack and Michelle and Sasha and Malia. And then he shows, you know, Willard and Ann and.
I never actually saw that.
Oh, yeah, well, it's yourself. Yeah.
I just saw it. I have to look it up. I didn't know that it was an actual, commercial, like, you know, a video. I just heard the audio. I didn't know that there was a whole.
Yeah, just Google Chris Rock vote for the white guy.
Yeah, because I remember him saying, you know, they called him Barry. How much whiter?
The third whitest name in America.
You know, Barry. Come on. You know, because I can imagine what they were doing with Barack. Oh, God. I mean, I had issues with my name, and my name is Tracy. And I'm like, okay, it looks like it sounds, it's Tracy. Trussaw, you know, I was like, no, it's just Tracy. And it is T-R-A-C. I'm like, dude, seriously, it's this Tracy. Come on. Phonetics, come on. See, back then, we still taught phonetics and stuff like that. You know, come on, these are the teachers. These aren't the students. This is just the treat that, you know, is tossed before them. I just, like I said, oh, and in Shotty Lowe's defense, you know, because I was talking about how, you know, these black men go out and have all these babies and blah, blah, blah. Well, in Shotty Lowe's defense, he does say, well, I take care of all my kids. Again.
Hey, you know what? If he's got enough to pay, make the child support payments for those youngins, And he saw to the cost, and he's more power to him, I guess. I don't know.
Can't, because you can't. Because that's the most irresponsible. Okay, at some point, you know, when you get to a certain.
Well, sooner or later, he's going to run out of money. He's going to baby mama himself right out of money.
Exactly. And at some point, take fucking responsibility and say, you know, condom maybe? I mean, okay, yes. When I got pregnant, now see, my pregnancy was an abnormality because, let's see, I was on the sponge, taking the pill, and his father was using a condom. And somehow, I managed to be in that 2%. And I got knocked up.
There is no old lady there?
You know, so I did everything I was supposed to do as a responsible, sexually active adult. And I still got pregnant.
10-4, can you go to the
But shit happens. What can I say? And I have a fabulous son, so I'm the better for it. But, motherfucker, why do you, you know, after the first one, okay, I'll cut you some slack. Shit happens. I might even cut you a little slack on the second, okay? But the third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth, tenth,
No, but
and
you're counting
11?
Wrong. No, you're counting wrong. You only count to two.
Oh, right.
Because there's 11 babies and 10 mamas.
10 mamas. Oh, that's right. That's right. That's right. So we had one bitch that was just this.
He just falls in love a lot.
Huh?
He just falls in love a lot.
No, his dick gets harder.
That's well, see. I mean, here I am trying to be charitable.
No! There's no charity to this. There is absolutely no charity to this. And when I heard about it, it made my blood run cold. And, you know, like I said, you guys go, you know, not that our petition is going to do anything about it, but if you care enough to say enough is the bullshit on television, and maybe, I mean, even Fox News is involved, which I find frightening. I find that troublesome, but whatever. But it could go either way. It could do, like you said, like, you know, with, you know, Manchin and giving all that publicity to Buck Wild. And it didn't stop the show from being aired, y'all. Cause like you
right,
said,
and see, they're gonna owe this. They're gonna air this one too.
Oh yeah.
But it raises up so many negative stereotypes and negative issues that people of good conscience can't resist commenting on it.
No.
Now, for instance, in the case of Buck Wild, you know, the fact of the matter is these kids are getting paid money, and
right.
They're not working on some mountaintop removal site.
True.
And they might be able to afford college.
Right.
You know, they're already getting them on the talk show circuit and stuff, as Ches Pazienza describes it. And you know, there might be a little flickering the spark of self-realization in there somewhere. Because the fact of the matter is, I mean, as somebody who recognizes that culture or who lives in this culture, those kids are no different than kids in Oklahoma. They're no different than kids in Kansas, and they're probably no different than redneck kids in California, because I know damn sure there are redneck kids in California.
Oh,
it ain't all
yes.
L.A. and San Francisco.
No, and San Diego.
I forget about San Diego. I'm so sorry.
San Diego's really nice.
Oh, I know it is, but see, everything, you know, it's my geographical ignorance, you know. It's like, you know, there's San Francisco and L.A.
L.A. Well, because, see, we have our redneck, you know, parts called Fresno.
Bakersfield.
And Modesto. Mostly Central California. And then you have parts of, like, you know, in L.A., our parts of, there's the Tujunga Sunland area. And, you know, it's part of it, and parts of Lancaster and Palmdale, because you have a lot of meth labs out there, because it's wide out, you know, it's out in the boonies, and, you know, it's just too big to patrol. So, yeah, we definitely have our, you know, our redneck sections, you know, of California. There's not all hippie love and all that. And then, you know, we have our overly conservative part called behind the Orange Curtain, better known as Orange County.
Yeah. Hey, you just got a comment in from our buddy Philip, and you need to hear this, Tracy. This
Uh-oh.
Is this no, it's not a criticism.
Okay.
This is just really trenchant. Philip writes, subject line, television's portrayals. Philip writes, how many working class families are represented on television? I've never seen a show about families living in apartments, rented homes, or small homes other than Roseanne. I'll add Good Times.
And
I'm of a certain
All of the
age.
Family.
No, they owned their home.
Oh, you're talking about renting. Okay, because they were working class, but they owned their home. Okay, got you.
Moreover, how many fathers are portrayed intelligently on television? Al Bundy, Homer Simpson, Archie Bunker? Nope, the fathers are usually sterile, personalityless men in the background or clueless idiots whom the kids routinely deceive and make smart-ass comments about. Yeah, I think the last one was probably, on the one hand, Ben Cartwright, and on the other hand, whoever Robert Young played in Father Knows Best.
Right.
Philip says, I understand and agree with Tracy's point, but my family has no representation on television either. We don't live in a $300,000-plus home in a comfortable suburb. As far as television is concerned, Tracy and her lover, you and your West Virginia family, and I, as a chronically ill adult, and my family, simply don't exist. Moreover, when I and Rick Smith were growing up in the projects in our respective cities, our families were invisible, too. For that matter, most of the Horns audience doesn't exist as far as television is concerned, which no doubt explains why we listen to the radio at least 3 hours a night. We're all dogs fighting for scraps off the table, and the day we realize how much we have in common, rather than how different we are, that's the day we can organize effectively to gain and maintain representation. As is evident in the Appalachian states, the inner cities, and so many other places, class is the determinant. The affluent African Americans in Prince George's County, Maryland, are just as intent as any other group in keeping that kind from moving from D.C. to the burbs. One of the things I valued most about Robert Kennedy is that he understood in his 1968 campaign how disenfranchised poor whites, browns, blacks, reds, and other peoples were. Of course, once he realized and appealed to the potential of unity among those groups, he paid the same price as Malcolm X after he returned from his Hajj, and Dr. King when he no longer talked exclusively about civil rights and began addressing human rights in this country.
They got took out.
Yeah. I mean, it's the truth. It's absolutely the truth.
I think I mentioned this book before, How the Irish Became White.
Yes.
It's one of those books that people need to read, because it's always as quiet as it's kept, except for here on the Horn, because I don't know, we read and we're intelligent and we know where the bodies, well, not enough bodies to bury, but we do realize it's never really been about race.
It's about class. Yeah.
And with class, with money.
And you just opened the door perfectly for me to issue a call or a reminder or whatever. I've been rereading, because the first time I read it, I had no Kindle or anything like that. I've been rereading Joe Bajant's Deer Hunting with Jesus.
Oh, wow.
And as fascinating as you found our little digression on Southern white class, I urge you, Tracy, and anybody who has never read this book, to go and read it.
Is this the same guy that wrote Rainbow Pie?
Yes, it is.
Because I bought it, and now that I'm going to be working a lot more than I have been working, I will be taking books in, because I actually have the paperback. So I will be reading that. As long as you promise to add to your reading list Warmth of Other Suns. I think we talked about
It's already on the list.
Okay, good. Okay.
It's a matter of being able to buy books, which happens only rarely.
Maybe I'll just have to send it to you. Can you gift on Amazon?
Oh, yeah, you can.
Okay, good. And it's a long book, but let me tell you, once you start reading it, you're like, and you being
Oh, no, long doesn't scare me.
No. But with you being a student of history and knowing about the Great Black Migration and all that happened from, the Civil War up until the 70s, you being who you are, it'll put, like you were telling me about how I didn't know about, because I think we talked about how I had no idea about when you were telling me about the subject matter of Rainbow Pie, about the great, what had happened to a lot of the folks in Appalachia when they were moved off their farms and all this for coal mining. Is that pretty much, the gist of it, or am I oversimplifying it?
Well, no, we're okay for these purposes, yeah.
Okay. So, for me, it's going to put a face on that, or something that I never knew about. But for you, because I know you knew about this, it's going to put, because it tells individual stories. And for me, what it touched me so, because that's my family. But because, you know, of how painful it was for blacks in the South during that time, no, I have no idea about my history, Bob. None. Because my great, I was 24 years old when my great-great-grandmother died. So I was old enough to know, you know, and for, to be told what had happened. What had happened was, but nobody wanted to talk about it. It was like, you know, what is that? What is that when you have selective memory? You know, if I don't talk about it, maybe it didn't happen. And I think, you know, from reading this book, it took, sometimes it's hard for me to read it because I had to fight back the tears about reading about what these people went through. And it's just, I think it tells the story of four or five different people. And I'm like, oh my God, this is just four or five out of how many? Hundreds of thousands?
Yeah.
You know, it is.
And yet here is Mr. Larry Ward, positively glowing in the dark with white privilege, talking about, you know, if only Dr. King had had a gun and been able to,
sure.
Right.
You know, right. Well, speaking
duck
of
duck and
guns,
roll, Doc, and shoot back.
Shoot back, you know. Speaking of guns, now, I have a question for you and the Horn and my Horn family members in light of what's been going on. You know, we just had another school shooting out here in California yesterday.
Yes, I know. Taft High School, was it not?
Yeah, Taft High School up in Kern County, which is where Bakersfield is in. Hey, so yesterday, you know, I take special needs kids to and from school, and we have several cabs that do the same. Now, we had a student in one of the cabs threaten another student, saying, I hate you, I'm going to kill you, I have a gun. Now, me personally, I would have called the police right at that very moment. Am I overreacting?
No.
Okay, I just had to ask.
No.
No.
Not in 2013.
Not in 2012, 2011, 2010. When was the ban on assault weapons expired? Was that 2004?
Yeah, that may have been 2000. It was during the first Bush administration, I'm quite sure.
Okay, so.
And after that, assault weapons deaths have gone up, 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 up.
As a matter of fact, from what I heard.
But, you know, if we talk about getting rid of them, James Yeager's going to bring his patriotic army and just gun us all the hell down with his semi-automatic assault weapons because he wants everybody to load up their magazines.
Yeah, my question is, well, did you hear, I don't, which idiot was it that said that that what happened at Newtown was just crisis actors, real children were not involved?
Oh, no. Yeah, those assholes are out there in profusion.
No, but this was somebody, what was his name? I just heard about him.
Oh, no, yeah, a professor down at the University of Central Florida or somewhere.
Right, I'm going to teach it. Mm-hmm. So, this, you know, this was just to keep, you know, for the Obama administration.
And he
this was for the Obama administration to, what was it? To be able to have a reason to take away our guns.
Yeah, but see, they're liars, Tracy. I mean, that's one of the things, and there's been some excellent work done in the last few days that has been had the lie put to it, is all these freaks, like Alex Jones, Hitler took the guns! No,
he didn't.
Germany was disarmed as a function of the Treaty of Versailles. And in fact, Adolf Hitler made guns more accessible as long as you were a proper Aryan and a member of the National Socialist Party.
Mm-hmm.
He liberalized gun ownership in Germany, you know, like the NRA wants to.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, just say that. Yeah.
For a proper white folk.
Yeah.
Have you ever read the book Negroes with Guns?
No. But I do know that some of the earliest gun control legislation was passed by the California legislature at the behest of Governor Ronald Reagan once he got all scared of them there Black Panthers.
Mm-hmm. But there's a book. It's called Negroes with Guns. It's more of a pamphlet than anything. But of course, it's during, I forget what state it's in, but you know, pick a southern state. And during the 40s and the 50s up until the 60s, I believe. And it was Black folks. It's like, you know what? This is our Second Amendment right to protect ourselves. So we're going to take it. So whenever white folks would come and try to raid their homes and stuff like that, they shot at them. It's a great book.
There you go. Exactly.
You know, it's like, so, you know, my Second Amendment rights as the Black person don't matter in this time in the South. So I can't protect my family from, you know, the hooded vigilantes that are coming after me and mine.
Oh, you can, but if you manage to kill off a couple of the Knight Riders, more Knight Riders will come. And they will kill 200, 300, 400 for every Knight Rider that got taken down.
That got taken out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I had a discussion today with one of my buddies about, you know, all this is because God is not in schools.
Oh, don't. Don't. And I don't have the strength for it tonight, Tracy.
No. I shut it down. I absolutely shut it down. I said, you know, God is everywhere. I said, because it tickles. It's funny, there was plenty of prayer in school during the South back in the day. Did those same prayers help those little Black kids that got killed, and the four little Black girls that got blown up in church and all that? Those same folks were praying in class. I said, I pray on a regular basis. There's nobody that can tell me when and where I can pray. And I think you said something the other day about how there's prayer in schools. Just asking the eighth grader sweating over that algebra test.
Bingo.
You know, God is where God is going to be. It doesn't matter if you have a time sanctioned exactly for prayer. If there is truly the love of God in your heart, you don't need sanctioned prayer. You just pray when you pray.
Hey, by the way, Tracy, let me back up with you real quick. I got a note in from Texas Betsy. You know, she's an educator
in Texas. Poor thing.
Yeah, and you were talking about, you know, whether to report something, you know, a threat, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
She said, "Tell Tracy I reported a kid yesterday for threatening another kid with elementary school scissors." It's just some stuff you do not fool around with.
No.
Well, Tracy, it's been a wonderful conversation. I just got a note in here from Dr. John that I think you're going to find fascinating.
Okay.
So I don't know how you can listen or if or whatever.
I can't unless, let's see, because I got you on Skype.
Well, I'll tell you what, you just stay connected for a minute.
Okay.
I'm gonna, and what I'll do is, I'll read this and then you can disconnect or whatever and somebody else can jump in on Skype.
Okay.
But stand by for a minute because I want you to hear this letter from Dr. John.
Okay.
Because this is pretty important stuff. This is the kind of history they don't teach on ancient aliens on the History Channel. Okay. Yeah. So, Tracy, have a good night, dear.
You too, my love.
Bye now.
Bye.
Tracy calling from her cab somewhere in the wilds of Southern California in and about L.A. No, this is important. This is what makes the horn the horn. Dr. John, you know, has considerable expertise in history, and he has expertise in language and journalism, and I remember the night we celebrated, thinking tonight about how we got the show started, celebrating Kim and Matthew's wedding coming up tomorrow in New York. I remember the night that we celebrated the awarding of John's doctorate in archaeology. And John can't get past, and I don't blame him, cannot get past this business of glow-in-the-dark white privilege Larry Ward of gun appreciating day, talking about, you know, if only Dr. King had had a gun. And John put it to paper. Well, okay, electronic. There's electrons involved, or packets. But you know what I mean. The subject line of Dr. John's note is, "This is really under my skin." He says, "I thought about calling, but this lends itself better to writing. I'm talking about this statement about if black people were armed, there'd have been no slavery. That's a repulsive, historically ignorant statement on every level, and here's why." Wow. You know, this, even that little paragraph, that paragraph right there is a reminder of the difference between, say, you know, the Horn and for-profit media like CNN. Larry Ward needed to have somebody say to him, "Your statement is a repulsive, historically ignorant statement on every level, and here's why." First, says Dr. John, let's think about a cultural biography of firearms and African-descended people. Guns were used by Europeans in their early attempts to dominate trade with West African kingdoms. First it was the Portuguese, then the Dutch and the English, who initially attempted to establish forceful trading and vassal relations with the Congo and Ashanti and others. Fact is, the African kingdoms kicked the Europeans' asses, essentially forcing them to trade as equals, though in time some did fall under direct European sway, notably Congo. Guns were used in an attempt to dominate African polities, but unsuccessfully. African states didn't need firearms to fight off Europeans in the early decades of contact. As the slave trade developed, guns became a valued trade item. Most slaves were acquired not by European raiding parties, but through peaceful trade with African polities. Firearms were a key medium of exchange. Guns and other things traded with coastal kingdoms were exchanged for slaves captured from the interior. So the idea that armed Africans would have halted the slave trade is nonsense. The slave trade was an established social fact that Europeans entered into and expanded. Guns, in fact, aided the slave trade. Now, says Dr. John, let's shift to antebellum America. It's difficult to generalize about enslaved people's access to firearms. Guns were variously prohibited to slaves and allowed to them. The latter is particularly ugly when slaves were allowed to hunt. It was so masters could save money by not having to feed them as well. They were expected to provision themselves. Some, of course, were unable to do so. In the very few cases of organized slave uprisings, guns played a role. The most prominent was Nat Turner's rebellion in Southampton County, Virginia, 1831. Something like 6 dozen white people, mostly slaveholders and their families, were killed. But literally hundreds of black people, most of them totally unconnected to Turner's rebellion, were lynched in the aftermath. The rebellion ushered in a crackdown on Virginia's enslaved and free black people, of which there were many, that was horrific and long-lasting. Rights granted to free and enslaved African-descended people in Virginia were revoked. There were bans and harsh fines for breaking them on travel, education, marriage, and contracts, as well as easing of laws restricting cruel punishment. Quakers and others in Virginia who were trying to improve conditions for enslaved and free black people were driven from the state. After the Civil War, Virginia had the lowest rate of black literacy of any state in the former Confederacy as a direct result of the fallout from Nat Turner's rebellion. So no, access to guns would not have kept African-descended people out of slavery. Access to guns was usually a sign of desperation among masters and slaves, or guns were a tool that resulted in increased oppression. closing, Dr. John says, and I'm constantly stunned that you and the listeners have sustained a program where I can write something like this with a chance it'll be aired. Amazing. Well, John, we're all just grateful that you took the time to lay that out. And grateful for everything that comes by way of our interactions among ourselves to increase the quantum of understanding beyond the simplistic BS that is prattled into the collective consciousness on a daily basis in other fora. And if there's an apology to be made, my only regret is that there aren't a million people hearing that. Instead of a few thousand. Kind of reminds me of something. One of the things that I saw in, I think it was Dar.fm. They said they're going to make it possible for people to start cutting clips of shows and then sharing them on social media. Right there is a moment that begs for that. And in the clip with Larry Ward, of course, Maria Roach of United for Change USA was right there and about to have a plum conniption when he said what he said about how arming in black folks would have prevented slavery. And that's not to say that she was ineffective. She was there. But her presence didn't make a damn bit of difference to a significant number of people watching the program or who are otherwise listening to Larry Ward of Gun Appreciating Day. I would submit that it is highly likely that the number of persons of color who have heard about Gun Appreciating Day and agree with the concept behind it, I would argue that that is a number approaching statistical insignificance. Anybody who was sitting there a nod in their head thinking that more guns would have prevented slavery is A, as John makes clear, dumber than a bag of hammer handles, and B, probably fairly racist, and C, CB above. I've become more and more convinced that the Second Amendment issues, as they're framed, are nothing but unmitigated white paranoia of the same type that has infected this continent from the moment that the first white person set foot on it. And I'll even go so far back as to include the Norsemen in that, because, you know, the little bit of data that we have about them tells us that even their contact with native peoples on this continent, people they called Skraelings, was unsuccessful because they had no idea how to live peacefully in land that they were, in the first place, stealing, on a continent that had a greater population than that of Europe, Africa, or Asia, and were living more successfully. You know, I've even had people say to me, well, Bob, you talk about it, well, you know, how horrible it was that white folk. Well, don't you realize you wouldn't be here? Yes, I do. but I am not so egotistical nor enamored of myself as to think that it might be possible that the world would have been a better place without white folks in Eden, because these continents were damned near Eden. The United States is on fire right now with what has now officially been proclaimed by the Centers for Disease Control as an influenza epidemic in 47 of 50 states. States 48, 49, and 50 will follow shortly, I've no doubt. Because infectious disease vectors faster than any cure can. But guess what? In 1491, influenza was unknown in the entire Western Hemisphere. In 1491, the head cold, the rhinovirus, was unknown in the Western Hemisphere. In 1491, measles, chickenpox, smallpox, polio were unknown in the Western Hemisphere. There were some diseases, but not nearly the ones that were developed largely as a result of animal husbandry in the old world. Jared Diamond, in his book God's Guns, Germs, and Steel, makes the cogent argument that it was not nearly as much the guns of the Spanish conquistadors that took down the people of Central Mexico as it was their filthy habits, their filthy selves. Of course, being agonizingly ignorant, they had no idea they were filthy. They were just amazed at why all those Indios insisted on bathing all the time. Jack, writing in from Shreveport, and thank you for the help this evening in meeting Dr. John's challenge, Jack. Jack says, a thought that crossed my mind during your reading of Dr. John's letter was that the right-wingers promote and finance the distribution and use of guns, yet block and defund education every chance they get. Signed, Jack. Paren. There was something in the letter that made me think of the skill of reading and the subject of education. I forget what. Except, you know, everything. Andy writing in, subject line, Larry Ward versus Dr. John. A comparison of Larry Ward, the useful idiot, versus Dr. John, the scholar, is no contest. Incredible, just unbelievable that Larry Ward gets any forum for his moronic idiocy. His Neanderthal mind is pure rot. But that's the thing. It's the for-profit media. That's why we call it the for-profit media. It's the same motivating factor that I was talking about with the damn drugs at the beginning of the program. Profit is what motivates them. Whoever is booking programs for Carol Costello, bless her little heart, over at CNN, booked that goober because this is a debate that has two sides. Horse feathers. There are not two sides as to whether or not a 5-year-old should get to be a 6-year-old. And anybody who says there are should probably be in a rubber room writing on the wall with a purple crayon between his or her toes. A little Thorazine darts sticking out of their neck. But it sells. It's good for business. Because that segment had a commercial in front of it and a commercial behind it, and the segment in the middle of it was designed to deliver the poor people who watched that segment, or what came before it, to deliver the people to the advertisers. not to deliver any meaningful information to the people tuned in. Because there was no meaning to the information that Larry Ward was presenting. You know? Yeah. Let's go back to the phones. A couple of lines open. Skype is open. On Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn. On the phones, 304-658-3333. Hey, welcome to the program.
How are you?
I'm well, Jim. How are you?
Pretty good, listening to all the stuff you've been talking about. Now I just can't understand why they would even put that stuff on the public forum about the idiot talking about he was going to kill or do whatever.
Yeah, because it sold some breakfast cereal or an exercise machine that's why.
Huh. Well, nothing surprises me about anything that comes on the television and stuff like that. But I did see something on the internet which was quite appalling, really. And it was about a federal employee who works for Social Security in Maryland.
Okay.
And on the internet was an official letter of reprimand for a federal employee in Maryland who works for HHS, Social Security, because he was farting.
Passing gas.
Yeah. They had the entire letter of reprimand. Of course, the names were redacted. Crossed out.
Well, I had no idea. I had no idea that flatulence was a punishable offense. Well, I mean, it has been here in West Virginia, but
I'm sorry.
Don't you remember that, Jim? A couple of years ago, a police officer charged a person with disorderly conduct because they farted in his cruiser.
No, I don't. No, I don't. I'm sorry. But I mean, God in heaven. Oh, Lord.
I mean,
but to have this put in a person's official personnel file as an official reprimand, 5 pages long, you should read it.
Jesus. I mean, after the show, send me the link if you don't care.
It's just right there on the internet. Just pull it up. I mean, the
internet's a big thing, Jim. I mean, I can't.
Just type in federal employee passing gas. I'm sure you pull it up. I mean, it's a 5-page official document, and how that got onto the internet from an official personal file. I mean, these things are governed by very strict laws, and they are not.
Well, yeah, and well, I mean, you've got some experience within that system, Jim. Can the aggrieved employee sue over it or go to some administrative proceeding to get that excised from his or her file? I mean, Jesus Christ, the average human being passes gas 13 times a day. It is a normal function of the human colon.
I doubt it, because in the official letter, they had dates and a series of times in which it happened. Now, how they gathered that information, I don't know. I mean, since when are federal offices monitored by Odorama? I don't know. But it's there, and you need to read it.
I've got the story here, yeah. Betsy sent it along.
Okay. I mean, that's the most incredible thing I've ever seen. I mean, maybe the guy suffered from meteorism. And that's when people pass wind, and they have no capability of it. I mean, that was one of the problems that Adolf Hitler had.
Well, they sent the, they sent this person to a doctor, and the gas passing didn't stop.
Well, I know Hitler took these things called Dr. Kirschler's anti-gas pills, which were made up of strychnine and belladonna. And, of course, I guess if nobody wants to go into any description of Hitler's gut, but nonetheless, it must have been quite an interesting thing, as he was the first German to ever break the sound barrier without an airplane, but nonetheless.
Well, poor Abraham Lincoln suffered prodigiously from inner troubles, and took something called Blue Mass, I think.
No, I've heard about that.
It was mercury-based.
Yeah, not exactly the best thing to put in your system, right?
Right.
And, of course, Abraham Lincoln had another a number of other problems as well. But, nonetheless, I was just totally amazed to see that pass across the screen this afternoon. I mean, why would a federal employee's letter of reprimand be put on the internet, even though the names were redacted, crossed out? Why? I don't understand that.
It's well, okay, we've got an update here coming from Sergi in Texas. Federal employees' flatulence reprimand rescinded. Sergi says, thankfully, according to this news piece, the reprimand has been rescinded. Hallelujah, and pass the beans.
Well, I'm glad to see that happen, because that wasn't available to me when I called you about it. But I'm glad that that happened.
Yeah.
But that should tell you something. About harassment in the workplace and things that supervisors can do. I mean, they had this... I can't believe it. They had, like, dates and times and stuff like that, and I don't mean to be repeating myself needlessly, but that has no place in the public forum.
No. But at least there is some, at least there's some procedure in place that,
well, I don't know.
Allowed it to be rescinded.
Well, I don't know how that happened either. The guy had a physician's excuse for it, or but you said he didn't.
No, apparently they sent him to a doctor. He went to a doctor. Nothing happened. Right. No, I'm guessing he was probably a member of some sort of, even though you know they can't strike or anything, probably a member of some sort of governmental union that actually went to bat for him.
Well, it's called bargaining and non-bargaining. It depends on where you're located. Now, in Maryland and near the District of Columbia, you have bargaining units, okay? They have some authority.
Yeah.
But in the outreaches of areas, local personnel offices do what they want to do and do so with impunity. And the federal worker has no protection whatsoever. So there's a great deal of variance between Maryland right there in the district and other places, if you can see what I'm saying. And these local personnel offices can do anything they want to a federal employee with impunity if he is not a part of a bargaining unit. And that's the reason I brought this up.
All I can say, Jim, is that there, this happens in an atmosphere in which government workers have been demonized. How long? Since Reagan? I'm from the government.
Really,
I'm here to help. The nine
really,
most dangerous.
It actually started. The civil service started to, or rights of civil service started to decline under Carter. Nixon was the last president who left the civil service alone, effectively.
Well, I just remember Reagan demonizing the government by saying the nine most dangerous.
The 9 most dangerous words in the world are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
Well, it happened to Carter, too. Carter was no help. I mean, Office of Personnel Management began to lose its control over a lot of things as early as the late 1970s when Carter was in the White House. And, of course, Reagan took up on that to demonize the federal worker, and it started with PATCO and a lot of other things, and, you know, basically do more with less, and attempting to make the federal worker into a pariah. So it's been going on a long time, well over 30 years. If you have any contact with people who work with Office of Personnel Management, if they are honest with you, they will discuss that with you and the decline of the rights of the federal employee who keeps this country going.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, you know, who runs all of the agencies that enable Congress to make their laws effective? It is the civil servant. And he has been picked on and picked on and picked on and picked on. And every election cycle, there is a move among whoever is running, whether it's Republican or Democrat, that they're going to be able to alleviate all problems and balance the budget on the backs of the 3 million people, or roughly thereof, who are members of the federal workforce, to make things all better. And that really makes me quite angry.
It should. No, I recognize this government, you know, right-wingers complain about, you know, we don't like big government. Well, how do they expect a government of a big country to run on a small government? That's like asking a Cadillac to run on a lawnmower engine. Right?
Well, yeah, effectively, it is. But then again, under their aegis, you will see vast expansion in certain areas of the federal workforce. And, of course, the authority is transmitted through CORs, or contracting officers' representatives, to bring a lot of private money and privatization into what was controlled by the civil service. I mean, the civil service is the backbone of your country.
Sure it is.
How it runs. Not private contracts.
And nobody's getting rich doing it.
No.
You know, every time I drive into Washington, D.C., Jim, it seems like if I'm eastbound on I-66, and I'm sure you know it well.
Well, it
seems like it doesn't matter what time, day or night, that I'm driving eastbound into D.C., but usually it's of an evening, so the traffic is not so bad. Between D.C. and the Beltway, there is always a full stop traffic jam.
Oh, good Lord, yes.
And every time I drive by there, I think, you know, those are folks who work in government who have to spend four hours a day in an automobile because they live so far outside D.C. And they're not all going to country estates. It just happens to be the near, you know, it's an apartment in Manassas or something.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, start time in D.C. for the ones who are on, you know, flex time starts at 4:30 in the morning. In other words, if you live in a certain place like Manassas, or if, you know, wherever, West Falls Church or whatever, you're going to have to get up at least by 4 o'clock in the morning in order to start the 5 o'clock rush in. And that's the reason they, at least when I was working in D.C., they had flex time. So they could at least try to keep the roads so non-congested. They even experimented with flex place in which the federal worker could work from his home. I mean, they
just to try to keep a little traffic off the roads.
And also, I mean, you know, basically to try to, yeah, exactly that, and also to make things a little less onerous for the federal worker. And they even had programs enacted when I was there called Boss Ride, in which you could receive certain remuneration for transportation expenses. I don't think you see that anymore.
I'm guessing probably not.
No, hell no. Hell no.
But, you know, in many ways, the GOP have won, Jim, because part of our jobless problem in this country is the number of people who have been rendered unemployed as a result of the insistence on cutting the size of government. There's hellacious shrinkage in the civil service.
Well,
and in state governments and county governments and municipal governments.
Yeah, that's the thing.
And I can't, and I'm damned if I can figure out anybody in this country who has benefited by that. Least of all the people who were rendered out of work.
Nobody has, because you have the people, number one, who are jobless, number two, the people whom they serve, who depend upon them for a lot of things that are very important in their lives and the function of their lives. And they come up with this shibboleth saying, well, we can balance the budget on the backs of the federal worker because he is our main enemy. And that's not true. They're people who are trying to help you by every means possible. And it's had a terrible demoralizing effect on federal employees. I mean, federal employee or federal employment is not easy to get into. Not if you're in the career service. It is very difficult.
I have no doubt.
And not if you have protection under Title V. But that, too, has suffered as well. I mean, with the the big agency? I can't even think of it right now. The ones who guard the airports.
TSA.
The TSA, yeah, exactly. They don't have certain guarantees that other civil servants do.
Oh no, that was a big fight during the Bush administration.
Oh yeah.
They were deliberately cut out of the loop.
Sure were.
And you know the dispute was whether or not they would be allowed to have any sort of collective bargaining or representation, and, you know, the Bush administration, hell no.
Yeah, that's right. And basically,
you know, because we want to trust the security of the United States to somebody making $9 an hour.
Right. And if the government shuts down the way it did back in 1995 or whenever, because I was a part of that, you can see how...
Well, you know what? It made me think of something.
Deleterious the effect of that would be.
Remember the story of that loon, Alex Jones, screaming at the TSA employee, refusing to remove his shoes before boarding, you know, going through the security line? You know, why wouldn't you just sap that bastard? You know, hey buddy, I get paid $9 an hour to do this. You know, go strip search him and cavity search him while you're at it. I go through those lines because I fly more lately than I have in other time periods. And I try to go through those lines with a smile for those folks, and a kind word and a little bit of decency.
So you have said.
Because while a lot, I mean, God knows, you see it on the right, you see it on the left, the TSA, fascism, blah, blah, blah. It's not because I'm afraid they're going to put me in an orange jumpsuit and send me to Gitmo. It's because I have an operating philosophy, Jim, that says that anybody who's out there working for a living, at least at first blush, is entitled to be treated like a human being.
Well,
and I can't tell you the number of times that I've said, you know, it happened when I went up to Wisconsin in early December. You know, I walked through and I said, you know, you guys have happy holidays now. And they looked at me like I had just grown a second head. And Well, thank you. As if they had probably not heard it that year or in years.
No, they haven't. And they will not hear it, except for a few people who will treat them, you know, equally as human beings, as somebody who's trying to earn a living. But God have mercy. The civil service, when I first entered into it, well, it's changed a hell of a lot, and not for the better.
No, not by any stretch of the imagination.
No, hell no, absolutely not. And it's just incredible to think that that's how they think this country is going to be able to govern itself effectively. Because, I mean, if you get into a national crisis situation or whatever, who is going to attempt to maintain order, to get things to where they need to be for people who are in need or whatever?
Yeah, and now you've got guys like this Tennessee who's, I'm ready to effing kill people.
Yeah, absolutely. And if he's ready to kill people, I mean, who's going to kill him if he gets into that think state?
Well, another, well, it was Ted Nugent, as a matter of fact.
Oh, God, that fool.
Well said, Jim, well said.
You know, I used to enjoy his music when he was with the Amboy Dukes. I really did. I mean,
Journey to the Center of Your Mind, sure.
Yeah, The Call of the Wild, that type thing. But this guy's just gone way off the...
Well, he has recently declared that gun rights... are going to make gun owners the new Rosa Parks.
Bob, since when have these people who have these guns ever been asked to sit at the back of the bus?
Well, since never. But see, they've got such a deep and abiding paranoia and persecution complex that in their own minds they always are. Because they're the guardians of our freedom. And what Nugent said is, he said, you know, it's going to have to be a civil disobedience movement when they come to take our guns away. We're just going to have to be the new Rosa Parks and sit there at the front of the bus and refuse to move. He says, no, I don't think it's going to take violence. He said, because I don't think the cops and our first responders out there, patriotic Americans that they are, will obey an order from Obama to come and take our guns away. Because, see, the new paranoia, when it was announced that there might be some efforts made via executive order, with the concept of which you are intimately familiar.
Yeah, an executive order could only be based upon a law that's already in place.
Right, and delegate certain administrative functions to the executive branch. Right.
Precisely.
And but it began being bruited about after it was announced that there might be some things done by executive order. Immediately, the right wing went absolutely stark raven, crazier than a sprayed roach. And Obama's going to declare that our guns is to be confiscated. And that's when Ted Nugent said he didn't think the patriotic police would agree to do such an immoral, dishonest, and unconstitutional thing, and that there would be a new civil rights movement in which gun owners would become Rosa Parks.
Oh, my God, that's so ridiculous. I mean, did Rosa Parks have a gun when she sat on that bus? No.
No, because, you know, 500 black folks would have been killed if she had, you know, by lynch mobs. All she had was a pair of tired, swollen feet.
That's it. And she did not want to be moved to another place on the bus where she should not have been asked to move in the first place.
And she had been taught to say no because she had been taken to, invited to. You know, that wasn't just a spontaneous occurrence, Jim. She had been educated at the Highlander Center in East Tennessee.
You know, I have a certificate of appreciation from the Southern Poverty Law Center that's signed by two people. and it's for a contribution to the Martin Luther King Memorial, and I think it's in Montgomery. And one signature is Morris Dees, and the other is Rosa Parks.
That's beautiful, Jim.
So I just don't understand these crazy fools who just try to make... Life is complicated, so complicated enough as it is. Why are these fools out there trying to make it even more so over a myth?
And that's what we're learning more and more. It is a myth of their own making.
And on that note, I'm going to leave you where I found you and wish you well in D.C. And I hope that your efforts there bear fruition. I have my doubts about it. I have expressed these to you, but, you know, I admire you for trying. And
the only way we know we're guaranteed to fail, Jim, is by not trying.
Well, good luck.
Thank you, Jim. Have a good night.
You too.
Bye now. Our good buddy Jim. Let me say we are $20 toward the $50 goal of the Beat Betsy bet. We've got about 24 minutes in which to come up with the remainder of that. It would help dig us out of the hole that we are in this week and this month, frankly. So if you want to help out, the PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com, or you can just use Bob Kincaid, BobKincaid, at gmail.com, or you can use snail mail too, and that address is at headonradionetwork.com as well. Onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello there, Bob.
Hey, what's happening, Kevin?
Speaking of donations, the one I sent you, I just got a thing back from PayPal, and I checked the address they gave me, you know, for what I had put, bobkincaid at gmail.com, and that was correct. So
There's a dot in front of the Gmail, Kevin.
On the one I sent to PayPal?
Apparently so, if that's what you copied into the email you sent me.
No, no. No, that was just a typo on my part in sending the email to you. I just checked this one, and everything's correct in the one I put into PayPal.
Well, folks do use it on a regular basis, so I don't know what went wrong.
I know. I don't understand, because the last one, you know, when I completed the transaction, told me it was sent to Bob Kincaid Horn or something like that. So, but anyway, I've got the email from him if there's any problems. So,
that it went through or didn't?
It said it may take a while for this transaction to go through. But
okay.
It's virtually the same information I put on the last email. Identical. You know, everything was done identically. So I don't know what the problem is with them. Maybe their computers are down, something like
well,
that.
Well, thanks to Betsy for doubling that, and we do appreciate that.
Yeah, that was the biggest reason I did it, is because I knew my money was going to get doubled. So thanks to her for doing it, and thanks to you at the Warren for, as I said in my email to you, for being able to do this program without worrying about advertisers or being... cut off, so to speak, by advertisers who don't like what you're saying. And this way, by donations from the people at the Horn, we don't have to worry about that. We just get Bob Kincaid and the Horn for 3 hours every day.
Well, and a lot more than Bob. You know, you guys are the ones that make it special.
So, anyway, I just can't believe this nutcase that you were talking about earlier. What was his name, Larry something or other?
Larry Ward.
Larry Ward. I want to know why he's not in president or in jail for making a threat against the president.
Oh, no. That was James Yeager of Tennessee. Sorry,
oh, yeah.
It's hard to keep up with our lunatics.
Yeah. Him, Alex Jones, and the other one all need to be in.
And maybe lunatic's not the right word either, Kevin. Homicidal maniacs? Well, yeah.
Yep. Yeah, I think that's pretty much what they are, and what scares me, at least with this guy from Tennessee today, seeing what he did, he means it. And if he doesn't mean it, one of his listeners, just like the Glenn Beck listeners, you know, they'll just follow whatever the right-wing person says and, you know, do their dirty work for the right-wing person. And that scares me, you know. And Jim talking about government workers, you've just got to really admire the TSA, Secret Service, FBI, for the work they do do, because I just can't imagine the stress they're under, especially the TSA and Secret Service with all the crazies that are out there. I mean, I asked a question the other day in an email, and I don't know if you read that part or not, but why wasn't Alex Jones arrested? If he stuck his finger in the chest of that cop, if I'd have been that cop, I'd have slapped handcuffs quicker on him. He wouldn't have even had time to react. I'd have had the handcuffs on him before he could even react to him.
I have a guess about that, Kevin. And my guess is this.
Yep.
If they had taken time to arrest Alex Jones, it would have taken a lot of person hours away from a process that is pretty harried in the first place.
Yep.
And it would have backed up the line of people behind him. You take people out and of line and you keep them off flights only in the rarest of circumstances.
Sure.
And so, I'll add a cultural multiplier into it. That was the airport in Austin, Texas. Now, Austin is a little allegedly liberal jewel in Texas, but it's still Texas, and people come from out in the wild countries, and they probably get screamed at, "I don't want to take my cowboy boots off."
Yep, exactly.
They probably hear it every day. And if Alex Jones was the first Texan to point a finger at a TSA official, well, I'll eat the windscreen on this microphone, because it is, after all, and I think I've got backup. I think our Texas friends in the Horn family will not say that I'm being derogatory, but will in fact back me up. If that's the first Texan to point a finger at a TSA official, I'll eat the windscreen on this here microphone.
Oh, sure, but I had heard he also, that the cop was called, and then he stuck his finger in the chest of the cop.
Yeah.
And that's why I was surprised he didn't get arrested, but my theory on why he didn't get arrested was, is if you arrested him, you're essentially giving him free publicity. So, you know, why give him the free publicity or the...
because just what America needs is a free Alex Jones movement. He already thinks he lives on a prison planet. The bars are in Alex Jones's mind, Kevin.
Yep. And if it's going to be such a bad prison planet, why doesn't he leave? You know.
First rocket out, I guess. A little backup coming from Texas Betsy. She said, Austin cops don't arrest white people for stuff like that unless they're homeless. That was an Austin Police Department officer, as I understand it. So don't be eating your computer parts. You're right.
Yep. So sad, but it's Friday on the front porch, so I'm not going to let things bother me too much today. It's kind of a cold, windy day here. Cold to the tune of it's going to be around zero tonight or below, with a wind chill probably in excess of 20 to 30 below zero. So I'm going to stay inside and stay warm and just enjoy listening to you and the other progressive talk show host that I listen to throughout the night, and just really enjoy, mainly wanted to call to just say I enjoy what you're doing and how you're doing it, and wish you a good trip. Monday, and you said you weren't going to be able to be on every day.
We're leaving Sunday, and I hope to be on every night, but I can't make any guarantees.
Yeah.
But I will Facebook and Twitter and post on the Horn website so that everybody hopefully will know.
Okay. Well, one other question I wanted to ask you: at the beginning of the show, you were giving out the time for the Prism History Series tomorrow.
Yes.
Was it?
That would be 1 to 3 Mountain Time.
Okay, thank you. That's what I thought I was right on the start time of, but I just wanted to make sure. So.
And by the way, A fascinating little informational factoid. You know, remember, Alex Jones was all upset about those little factoids. Isaac just sent this along. When we're talking about TSA workers, starting out in the TSA, pay band A, because they don't use GS pay ranges. Pay band A, minimum $17,000, maximum $24,900. And it goes up ever so slowly. If you get all the way up through 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, up, if you get up through the 13, up to the 13th rung of the pay band M, minimum $120,236 a year, maximum $155,500.
Right.
I'm guessing most folks aren't at pay band M.
I'm guessing it's done so slowly that the only way you could get a pay band M is to work there about 70 years.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah, good work if you can get it. Emphasis on the word if.
And they don't even allow these people to be under a GS pay grade.
No.
That's really sad, because they do, for what they put up with and have to deal with every day. You know, there's this flu going around, and these poor guys have got to be in that environment all the time, you know, aside from other things. I get up just as upset as anyone. I practically had to strip for one time going through the airport. But it's not their fault. It's the paranoid society with which we live in, coupled with the actual loonies who will try to put a bomb on a plane. But certainly don't hold it against TSA people for doing that. And,
no.
You know, for those who talk about the TSA, it's a government, you know, all that government control and government conspiracy, and they're just, you know, one of their Alex Jones' favorite things is to say that the TSA is to get us comfortable with, and there's a better word that I'm thinking of, but to get us comfortable with all this extra security and searches and everything like that. No, Alex, they're just doing their job because we don't want another plane to blow up in midair. And
yeah, because, right. And granted, all of that has made the act of flying less pleasant, but most of the factors that have made flying less pleasant have to do with how the airlines operate in and of themselves. I mean, the TSA did not make commuter jets have seats that are jammed so close together that you're pretty sure the damn things were last used on the commuter run between the Keebler Elf tree and the Lucky Charms leprechaun's house.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I've ridden in those little stupid things before. And
I'll be getting on one real soon.
Oh,
it won't be one of the little commuter jets, but I'll be getting on another plane real soon. And you know, I'm 6 feet two and 230 pounds if I'm behaving myself, and it will not be pleasant.
No. And then they have the temerity for someone who's overweight by a disease of some type to try and make them pay for an extra ticket. And, of course, that violates the ADA Act, and in some cases I can see where that may be necessary, but, you know, it's all, again, driven by what you're talking about with the prescriptions.
I've got a transcontinental hop coming, and I've got a feeling that I will probably be seated, you know, because I'm not complaining about anybody else, but what happens is if you take 2 6-foot-2, 230-pound guys and sit them next to each other, neither one is comfortable. If you take a 110-pound female and sit me next to her, she's not comfortable.
Yep.
And then I'm like pulling in my elbows and stuff, you know, trying to keep from it. Yeah, it's a miserable experience. But the government didn't do that. I seem to recall a certain president named Reagan who was all mad for deregulation that led to it, and creepy people named Carl Icahn and things like that. Hey, Kevin, I got to roll. I'm going to try to get one more call in. But it's awful good to hear from you.
Have a good trip on Sunday, and I wish you well in Washington.
thank you very kindly, and thanks for the help.
Yes, sir. No problem.
Bye now, Kevin.
Have a good evening.
From Colorado Springs, Colorado Springs, that's our buddy Kevin. Thanks to Kim for helping out. I am proud to announce that we have actually met Beat Betsy bet. So thank you very kindly, one and all, who helped do that, because you helped dig us out of the hole that we've somehow gotten ourselves in here with the month of January. To the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob, it's Richard in Northern California.
Well, hey, Richard, how are you?
Cold, to be honest. For us, it's cold. It went out down.
Yeah, thank you for the "for us" part.
Oh, yeah, it went down almost to freezing last night. Somebody wrote a song called "Warm San Francisco Nights." Obviously, nobody who had ever been here. Because it's how
it is. Yeah, and then there was Sausalito summer nights, too, and it doesn't get much warmer over there, does it?
No, and it's too expensive in Sausalito. But that's in Marin County. Kind of Tony over there. Nice. But anyway, in our remaining, 9 minutes,
And I'm actually gonna see a little bit of that soon. I mentioned that a minute ago.
Are you coming out here?
Yeah, under less than happy circumstances. Next week I'll be attending a memorial for our dear friend Joan Mulhern, who passed away recently. And it was a real shock to find out that the executive director of an ally organization, and a person of whom I really liked, the executive director of Rainforest Action Network, Becky Tarbotten, passed away the day after Christmas in a horrible accident. And there'll be a memorial service for her out there, so I'm going out and pretty much turning around and coming back, but I'll at least see it.
So where are you going to be?
San Francisco.
Well, San Francisco is unique in that it is the only Eastern-type city I know of in the West, meaning, you know, dense, compact, things close together, houses butted.
Yeah, all just kind of crammed onto that peninsula.
Yeah. It's actually very small in area. But let me tell you, since time is limited, a couple issues on my mind. One is pretty small. Is there any way that I can download the Prism West Virginia series only audio, not with pictures?
I need to talk to Ben about that. I have sent him those audio files over time, and at one point we were going to be putting them up on their own little separate subheading. I need to check on that. That's the short answer to that.
Yeah, that would be really cool. As I told you before, Dr. Bill makes me stoned. And I'd like more.
I will remind him of that tomorrow.
Okay. I mean, we didn't learn.
But don't expect that to be going into any grant proposals, okay?
Richard says he's stoned.
I get so wasted on Dr. Bill. Here.
Topic number two. You know, I like to think about solutions for things. I think, I think we can get very bitter and chew our cuds with bitterness. And I like to try to see if there's a silver lining to anything. And I've been thinking about religion, you know. And you're a lot closer to that than I am, because I one of the few good things I ever got from my parents was that I'm an atheist. And, I feel good about that, and I feel lonely about that, and I feel bored about that. You know, being an atheist is not terribly interesting. We don't have saints. We don't have statues. We don't have pictures.
You remind me of that song that Steve Martin, that bluegrass song Steve Martin sang a year or so ago about the atheists ain't got no good songs.
He may be right. You know, it's a dilemma. And of course the opposite is so opposite. I mean, the thing that.
But then again, Richard, you know what? I just thought of something. Maybe there is an atheist song. Because I remember my mother, who could not carry a tune in a bucket, and passed that gift on to me, I might add, going about her day as I was a child, and every now and then, she would cut loose with nothing, nothing, all day long, how do you like my nothing song? Well, that's the freaking atheist anthem, isn't it?
I don't know it, but yeah, I mean, you know, sometimes I get invitations from various atheist organizations, and I'm not inclined to sign up.
Yeah, the angry Indian just told me in chat, he said, no, we atheists just get rejected for ignoring ghosts.
Yeah. But, you know, the thing that occurs to me is the appeal of a church is so profound emotionally. It's really worth considering this, that I think for a lot of people, a church represents acceptance, ritual.
A social hub?
Yes. And a chance to be in on, you know, to be in on the greatest, you know, the greatest game there is, salvation, right?
Yep, so, buying them tickets into heaven and out of hell.
Right. And so, what can we do about that? I mean, how can we, is it possible to enlist pastors in their own Christianity? Because they're not now. What do you think? I mean, you're closer to this.
Well, I mean, what do you need? Or what do you mean?
I mean that, you know, I think that what Jesus said was pretty straightforward, you know, his teachings. As I understand it, I mean, I could use donations of a few Bibles to mark up, but so I know more of what I'm talking about. But that's how it seems to me. We get a tremendous amount of hypocrisy from the, and as far as I know, you know, what Jesus said was pretty straightforward. Am I right?
No. No, there are a lot of passages that make you think that maybe, somebody picked the wrong mushrooms that morning.
Okay.
I mean, there's somebody's mama, you know, gut the heathens, or I can't remember. But no, there's some real live goofy stuff in there. And that's the thank you.